ceramic, and the material of the diode is really silicon, it's more the properties of that silicon with the current through it that makes it vibrate at the frequency of light. So is there really a gas reaction? Not really. This is more of a solid state converting current to light frequency directly in the material. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Now, since you've built power supplies for these things, Glenn, you probably know, is there a slight negative impedance characteristic of the light-emitting diode itself? If I slightly increase the current or decrease the current from the normal operating position, so to speak, and I plot voltage drop across the diode for that amount of current, is it a positive resistor or a negative resistor? Is it a little bit like a tunnel diode? If it had negative resistance, slightly higher current would make a slightly lower voltage drop across the device, in which case you'd have to be kind of careful in the way you design the power supply so you don't get a runaway condition, particularly as a function of temperature. So I wonder if it has a little bit of that characteristic, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, the correct modeling of the LED is it follows all the same characteristics of silicon diodes. So although the voltage drop is considerably higher, the characteristic is as current increases, the voltage drop is increasing. So it is a positive coefficient. It's not negative. And so more current, more voltage drop. And this is true of basically all diodes, with one exception in certain cases, the Schottky diode. And the Schottky diode does the same thing. It has that positive coefficient, but as the temperature of the Schottky diode is increasing, the voltage drop starts to drop. It becomes lower at higher temperature. But to really answer the question correctly, as current is increasing, the voltage drop is increasing, provided the temperature is constant. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
In the case of a light-emitting diode, does the voltage drop decrease with higher temperature? And therefore, of the power supplies you designed, did you tend to make them more constant current supplies rather than constant voltage supplies in order to compensate for various temperatures of the light-emitting diode? Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
In most cases, Dick, the primary concern with the light-emitting diode is the chromescence. In other words, you want to get the correct frequency of light and for the wafer. So in most cases, the current is constant. So to keep constant current in the LED is really what's king. The other thing is, as far as temperature compensation, in most cases, the idea there is to do the best possible heat sinking to make sure that you don't have a temperature rise that will damage the diode. So in most cases, when you see heat sinking taking place on the LEDs, it's usually to keep the LED in a safe operating condition, and the constant current is maintained to get the correct chrominance color. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
And similar to all solid-state devices, if you can keep the temperature down, my guess is the life goes up very fast. And if you're doing a poor design where the diode runs hot, my guess is you start chopping into the life of the thing real fast. Now, when you talked about chromescence, as I go to higher or lower current than the design current, does it tend to shift toward the blue and toward the red, respectively? Is that where the chromescence tends to shift as a function of exceeding or not achieving the right amount of current? Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Yeah, there is a bit of variation in that, most of which is corrected. Generally, most of the LEDs that I've seen and the curves associated with them is the frequency tends to increase with current. So what you find out is that most of the higher powered LEDs, in other words, the LEDs that give you the most amount of light, tend to be at the higher end of the frequency curve, and they're also usually the ones running at the higher currents. How that's corrected is with lensing. In other words, generally there's another material like a yellowing effect that gets placed on top to basically bring the color back to what's more referred to as like the warm white color.
Now, that yellowing effect, is that a filter or is that a fluorescent material? In other words, is there a kind of material that the light-emitting diode ultraviolet portion hits it and it emits red light, and with the right amount of red added to the LED output, The eye now sees it as a warmer. Is there some of that action going on in some of these LEDs, Glenn? K2LIW?
Exactly, Dick. That's pretty much what's happening. It really is a filter, and the filter does recombine in the most efficient way the frequency output of the light into the warm white region, where it's a much more pleasant light, where the unfiltered one tends to look more like a bluish kind of harsh color. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, my favorite green light-emitting diode pointer. What's really going on inside is that it's got a very fancy crystal that has a frequency doubling. The real light-emitting diode in there, and the more efficient light-emitting diodes, the earlier designs, happen to be infrared. So there's an infrared light-emitting diode. The signal coming out of it hits this fancy crystal. The crystal doubles it up to something like 540 nanometers. The real light-emitting diode is running at 1,080 nanometers approximately. There are fancy crystals, there are fancy kinds of phosphor that will literally absorb at one wavelength and re-emit at another, and do it with rather high efficiency. And the nice thing about a green light-emitting diode is the same number of milliwatts. You're not supposed to exceed 5 milliwatts to be eye safe. 5 milliwatts of green looks 10 times brighter than 5 milliwatts of red, if the red happens to be 670 nanometers. It's just the way the human eye operates. So you get a lot more apparent brilliance out of a green light-emitting diode. And so let me drop this simple little pointer of mine. On a dark night, the aerosols and dust particles and other things that are in the air will make it act like a light sword. So if I was running an astronomy class and I wanted to point at a particular star with my light-emitting, my green laser pointer, almost everybody in the crowd would see exactly what star I'm pointing at, even though they're not standing right alongside of me, if you know what I mean. So they're kind of handy. KC2WGB, K2RAW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB, and that came from a 15-year-old. I think that was an excellent question. Okay, well, we better get over to Paul, and that's it from the mailbag. And thanks to everyone who participated. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, between you and me, John, we didn't quite answer his question. Where is the light really coming from? There's some kind of magic in the very specifically fabricated silicon that's inside of a light-emitting diode, and there's a lot more going on. There's fancy layers in there with just the right thicknesses of the layers, and so it's a diode-like action, and I think it's a forward bias diode, Schottky-like diode, but I'd like to believe there were some websites that give a better explanation than we did tonight. We gave a little information, but what's really going on at the atomic level, I don't think we answered that question, and maybe we'll try a little more next week. Paul? What has NASA been doing? And what's the latest on the, I think it's the Chinese lander that's going to be landing on the moon, if it hasn't already done so. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good, Dick. This is WS2N. We call that the Jade Rabbit. That's an interesting project that was kept pretty secret for a long time, and only in the last few months they really released pictures. Within, let's see, the other day was 10, probably 8 days now from now, they plan on going into orbit and then landing on the moon. And then soon after landing, they're going to release a rover, 308-pound rover, drive around on the moon with instruments on board. It's got a radar to penetrate 200 meters below the surface. It's got four cameras. The lander itself is going to be stationary. That has a telescope on board to look at the middle of the galaxy. So they're going full blast, and they have plans on future lunar landing missions, and eventually manned missions. I mean, that's their goal, some people are thinking that the next steps on the moon will be the Chinese, with the Chinese flag. So we got to get on the stick here. Let me drop it. European Space Agency launched a rocket 10 years ago called the Rosetta. I remember talking about that a little bit on the net. When that went up, it was launched from French Guiana by an Ariane 5 rocket that's there, a heavy lift vehicle. And it went through many gravity assists, three Earth gravity assists, and one Mars gravity assist to get to a comet. And they're closing in on it now. It's going to take about 10 years to get there. Right now, the Rosetta spacecraft is asleep. You know, they went to a sleep mode after testing Mars, testing equipment. They pretty much shut everything down. But they're going to bring it back. They're going to wake it up in January, a couple of weeks from now. And in May of this year, it will go into orbit, not just past one of these comets. It's going to actually orbit it. It's a comet 67P with a big long name, two long names of the people that discovered it years ago. So not being outdone, they are going to launch a lander from the Rosetta spacecraft and land on the comet. It's got these harpoon type of action that when the lander comes down, it's going to pierce the comet, and this way it will hold itself to the comet for a number of reasons. They don't want it to go anywhere. They don't want it really to bounce. And the other reason is they have a drill on board. They want to drill about, they gave it in centimeters, but I think it's about 8 inches into the ground. To see what it's made of. It's got about 10 instruments on board the lander. Everything is solar paneled. Solar panel on the lander, solar panel on the Rosetta spacecraft, which will be in orbit above. And that will be acting as a repeater. And this thing is coming toward the sun, and it plans on staying in orbit as it gets near the sun, goes around the sun, and starts heading back out all the way to Jupiter. That's the planned mission time, which would put it at the end of 2015. It's an interesting flight by ESA, the European Space Agency, called the Rosetta mission. The lander, by the way, is called Philae, P-H-I-L-A-E, is the name of the lander. Another thing I want to bring up, I know we're short on time, so I'll try to go quick, is the SpaceX Falcon 9 Orbital Science SES-8 mission, which I've been talking about, it seems like forever, because they've had three scrubs over the last month or so. They finally did get off the launch bed, launch complex 40 that they actually bought up really from the government. I mean, they rebuilt this whole launch pad, and they use it for themselves. They finally got off the pad last Tuesday, and I got a chance to watch it on the computer. NASA doesn't put it on their NASA TV, and the reason being it's a commercial flight. It's commercial company that's putting it into orbit, paying SpaceX. Orbital Science, another commercial company, built the satellite, the SES-8, and they put it up into geosynchronous orbit, first time a private company ever did that, for a company in Luxembourg that's paying for everything.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
SpaceX TV, it's a webcast. Comes on about a half hour before the lights drop it. This is WS2N. So, their improved Falcon 9, they call it the 9.1.1,
version of the original Falcon 9. The other ones they've used for testing, they've used to send cargo to the International Space Station. But this is the upgraded one. This is about 60% larger than that. It successfully launched in California about a month or so ago for the first time. And again, it's a successful launch from Florida. This time they got down to the zero count with no problem. The other days they had all kinds of problems. One time there was oxygen in the igniter line that they have. I have the information on that if you want that. What kind of gases and everything's involved in that. How that reacts. It's just a gas that when it gets in the presence of air or oxygen will actually ignite. They use that for an igniter. Even so, the first stage and second stage, they run on the same chemicals there. The RP-1 is the kerosene, refined kerosene, and they run on liquid hot oxygen. But to light this stuff, they have these igniters, and some oxygen got into the line, and computers picked that up, and that's why it shut down at one time. So this time it went fine, and now they're preparing for another launch. They wanted to get it off the ground before the end of the year. I don't know if they're going to make it, but they're going to try. Another company, DICOM, is putting it up. TICOM is something to do with another geosynchronous orbit over Asia somewhere. Another similar private paying group is going to pay for this. And in fact, most of SpaceX contracts are all private. It's actually about 60%. The other 40% are NASA paid. And if that goes well, in end of January, maybe the beginning of February, they plan on launching another rocket to the International Space Station using this upgraded version of the Falcon 9. And this time with a heavier payload, a lot more stuff will be in the Dragon spacecraft when it goes to the International Space Station. And again, this other flight that's going up about a month from now is also built by Orbital Sciences, the same company that put the SES-8 satellite up. This one's going to do is also built by them. So it's really a collaboration between these two private companies that are also competing against one another to deliver supplies to the space station, and eventually, in SpaceX's case, deliver astronauts to the space station. So, Orbital Science does not have a plan to do that. Their rocket, the Antares, and the Cygnus rocket, the Cygnus spacecraft, are just a cargo spacecraft, which has already successfully done just that. They plan on launching another one couple of weeks from now, actually on the 17th, and it should be a night flight around a little after 10 o'clock. These flights can easily be seen from Long Island, Connecticut, anywhere on the coast, probably even from Rhode Island all the way down to Virginia. They'll launch from Wallops Island, and this one, hopefully it's a clear night, you'll be able to see this thing rise above the horizon on the way to the International Space Station. There is another private company that's involved with NASA, but they're pretty far behind, but they're still pushing. A company called Blue Origin. Blue Origin has just finished testing one of their rockets, again, built by themselves, built and designed by themselves, similar to what SpaceX did. And they plan on eventually using it for their spacecraft, which will be called the New Shepard. Right now, they have long-term plans doing orbital flights, but they want to be...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And on launching astronauts on suborbital flights. And that's not their long-term goal. Eventually, they want to put astronauts into orbit as well. And one other topic, and then I'll try to back you, Dick, is there was a launch in Vandenberg Air Force Base a few days ago on the 5th of an Atlas V rocket, and that was putting a military spacecraft up in orbit. But they have a lot of them on board, so they added about it's 9 spacecraft, smaller ones, that went up, also up in the polar orbit. And Atlas V is a big rocket. So one of the 9 spacecraft, only there's one of them that weighs only a couple of pounds, the CubeSat, is actually constructed by a school right here in the New York area, in Brooklyn, Javits. Well, the Medgar Evans College, near Prospect Park over there, in college. These people ticket this CubeSat together, and they have it set up where they're going to be receiving data from the GPS satellites, and somehow they're going to use that information to analyze the ionosphere. Can't get much detail on it, but they're using the UHF amateur band for uplink, and VHF is also involved. They have a CW beacon. Outside of that, I can't get much information. My guess is somebody is from Brooklyn, from Mega College, is probably listening. They could always email me if they want with details. And I'm at spacenetreport@gmail.com. So that's it, Dick. I went through about 5 different topics, but if you want to discuss any of them or something different, let me know. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, TechNet, WS2N.
Yeah, thank you very much, Paul. 9 spacecraft were launched along with that Vandenberg launch on December the 5th, the Atlas V you talked about. Were all 9 of those spacecraft CubeSats, or just a couple of them CubeSats, or just one of them a CubeSat? Paul, go ahead.
Well, they had the CUNY, C-U-N-Y, that's the Medgar Evans College. That was a CubeSat. There was another one, what was the name of that? I think that was IPEC, I think. That was another school, Polytech in California, that put that one together. And then there were some other ones similar, but a little bit bigger. Give you a list. It was there was one called the AeroCube, so that was probably a small one, too. AeroCube 5. There's the Alice, that was for the Air Force. Then they had the Firebird that come out of Montana State University. The IPEX, like I mentioned, from California Polytech. The M-Cube comes out of Michigan, some Michigan laboratory. And SMDC, and then look to see what that stood for. Charlie, that's another one. TACSAT, that was a U.S. Army Missile Defense Command. That was a big one. And a couple more, TACSAT. I think it was a total of 9 satellites put on this one launch vehicle launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think almost all of the polar orbit launches are done from Vandenberg to make sure that the booster doesn't have the capability of falling down over habitable land like it would if you launch from Florida with a polar orbit. Do you believe this launch is a low Earth orbit or a medium Earth orbit? In other words, are these things going to be short-lived because they're low Earth orbit, or are they going to be around for a long time because they're a medium-high orbit? Over to you, Paul.
I thought I saw 400 miles, so that's up there pretty good. Whether all of them wound up at that height or not, I don't know. They have the capability of separating at different times, so I don't know about the heights of these satellites. The military one will stay up there, and yeah, Vandenberg. You could get almost a perfect polar orbit out of that. In fact, they had plans on launching shuttles. In fact, one was ready to go back in the, right before a Challenger, back in the early 80s. In fact, they used the Enterprise, the one that's on display in the city here, on that aircraft carrier, the Intrepid, Enterprise, they use that as a mock-up to make sure everything, how everything fit, how it was going to look, and I have pictures of that at Vandenberg Air Force Base, but then Challenger happened, and they canceled that program, but you were going to have, you might remember the earlier shuttle flights, there were some that were, you didn't even know when they were going to go off until the last minute. They were military, supposedly top-secret types of flights. They were going to have a lot of them from Vandenberg Air Force Base, but they stopped out and dropped it. I think the highest inclination you get is around 65 or 64 degrees or something from Florida. So we've had some space shuttles that higher inclination. And you got to remember the International Space Station is at 56.8. Something like that, 56.2 or something, inclination. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, 400 miles, and that's the altitude of this recent Vandenberg launch of the Atlas V. That's well above low Earth orbit, entering what I think is medium Earth orbit. So that's going to be around a while. And I believe the International Space Station is in the vicinity of 260 miles, so 400 is... it's up there. So they're going to be around a while. And that CubeSat that's going to be doing something with the global positioning satellite system signal. And is it going to be emitting a signal by which, because they're above the ionosphere, I believe, you've now got another signal to probe the ionosphere. Is that approximately what it sounds like this Medgar Evans CubeSat is going to be doing, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I went to a couple of websites, including the college website, but I can't really get enough detail, but it looks like they're using the GPS satellites, which they fly at, I think, 11,000 miles. Roughly half the distance between geosynchronous orbit altitude. I think they're around 11,000. But somehow they're going to be receiving that, and this is going to give them information on the ionosphere. I don't know how that's going to work. But maybe through the ionosphere on a lateral type of effect. I'm imagining that. Maybe a satellite is off to the side, and instead of going straight down at it, that won't do much. But maybe on an angle through creating a denser situation, you might get some kind of a reading. But whatever it is, they're going to convert this information and transmit it back down. And I can't get that much information. They are using UHF and the VHF hand band, so my guess is hands involved. So if they're out there, they could always email us. So a couple of things on about the flight on... ARRL letters that they mail, but nothing about this particular satellite. The other ones, back to you, Dick.
I'm going to make a guess that this CubeSat from Medgar Evans College is going to be receiving the precise timing signals from the global positioning satellite transmitters, and then in turn, if it transmitted a signal so accurately timed in that manner, down to Earth on other frequencies, the other frequencies from the CubeSat are going to be going through the ionosphere. So as the CubeSat moves and you receive the signals on the ground with the right kind of equipment, you're now looking at further ionospheric effects, and you can compare the timing, because the CubeSat is going to be getting exact timing from the GPS satellites it's looking at. That's a guess on my part, Paul. So it's another thing above the ionosphere, sending out signals that are accurately timed, and then by checking the timing of those signals that you receive on the ground from the CubeSat, you know something about the ionospheric characteristic of transmission at that frequency. Does it sound like a possibility, Paul, for the WSJN, K2LAW?
Yeah. It sounds like they're going to be, they've got to be timing something, either frequency change or something, or maybe amplitude change, or, there's got to be something that they're thinking about to do this. Now, what amazes me more is here's this college in the middle of Brooklyn, and they put together this program probably who knows how long ago, and eventually they develop it, they contact the powers to be, and the next thing you know, it's years later, and here's their little satellite sitting on an Atlas V rocket, which is, I mean, it's no small rocket, it's a big freaking rocket. The Atlas has been around since, 1966 or something, and they've had all these different versions, and naturally it's the biggest of that group, sitting in the middle of California and launching this thing up into polar orbit. To get this done, the logistics and contact meetings that must have taken place, to put a 2-pound satellite, a little bit more than that. I saw pictures of it. It was just a little cube with a bunch of solar panels all over it. Back to you there.
Well done. Sounds to me like those guys are going to be pretty proud. I guess I don't know a great deal about Medgar Evers College. I believe he's a famous man in history, and that's about as much as I know. All right, anyone have any further questions for Paul on any of the space subjects that you've heard or any other space subject you want to know about, give us your call letters right now, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Medgar Evers, I believe, was a black man who was shot in a walk down south.
Oh, of his house, they shot him in the driveway, John. Back to you, Dick.
Keys 2 QAQ. Go right ahead, Glenn. Queen Yankee, this whiskey is going to be right at the QIQ. Go ahead, Glenn, first.
Yeah, Dick, I was just going to ask you after this one. I know you had some questions about the physics of the LED light, and I can probably get some light on that shortly after this. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Why don't you shed some light on that right now? Pun intended. Go right ahead, Glenn. Wait for the beeps.
Yeah, I know we probably jumped off the subject before. I thought I was just going to give you the simple answer, but the basically, in a PN junction in a diode, which if you look at the area, especially in gallium arsenide diodes, there's basically a primary carrier and a hole on the other side, right at the PN junction. So if you start off with a substrate, silicon substrate with gallium arsenide, when you let it drop, there's a typical spacing of holes right at the PN junction, so that when you create a forward carrier in the forward direction, basically in any diode, what's happening is the current starts to flow and the current carriers start dropping into holes in one direction. That's what gives the diode its forward direction. If you control the spacing between the holes, you can actually adjust them for the frequencies of light. It just turns out that one of the easiest ones to do happens to be red. So that if you actually adjust the holes in by using a material like gallium arsenide with light doping, you can actually create red light. Now, why don't all diodes put out light? Well, the reasoning is it's not just the light has to leave the current carrier at 90 degree angles, so it's always perpendicular to the direction that the current is dropping into the hole spacing. It always has to come out at a right angle. Let me let it drop. So when the PN junction is placed, you basically have to spread the PN junction as wide as possible over the largest surface area, and then put something that's going to actually diffract the light in one direction, which is something that basically focuses the light, almost like a crystal. And then this way you get the light exiting that diode drop in one direction. So that's why I was trying to use the crystal effect to try to explain how the frequency of light was vibrating and leaving the device, but it truly is the spacing between the electron carriers and the holes. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Dick, you think that's part of that reverse engineering that was going on?
NWS2N?
Maybe not. John, I think John is referring to this book I was talking about last week, which a few people have gone and bought it. Some of them are kind of happy with it. The name of the book is... I'll have to go get the book and give you the name in a minute. It's the... a very authoritative book that represents 20 years of research by two investigative reporters about what happened in Roswell starting on July 3rd, 1947. There's strong evidence that a craft of unknown origin landed and a lot of hardware was dropped and a lot of hardware was investigated. Paul, I think it was, you want to make a comment? WS2N, K2LAW.
I forgot, I wanted to mention that Weimark did start that AstronomyNet on last Thursday at 8:30, and it was very good. Craig was excellent net control, a lot of good topics, but I think that's going to be very successful. They said every two, I think the first in the first and third Thursdays, they're going to have that at 8:30. So, I guess Craig is going to do it. That was his call. That was that case, I don't know what it was, KD2, CX. Let me see, I must have it here. Wrote it down somewhere before. KD2, CXK, that's what it is. Back to you, then.
Yeah, I think he said he had a good number of people signed in. They got pretty deep into discussing Cassegrain and refractors and reflector-type telescopes, and Dobson mounts and German equatorial mounts and so on. So they got into some pretty deep subjects and looked like they were going pretty strong there for quite a number of hours. So roughly 8:30 Thursday night, first and third Thursday of every month, AstronomyNet on this frequency. And Craig has had his first session, and there will be more from all we can tell. Joe, I think you wanted to make a comment. KC2QYW, KQYW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger. I was waiting for the four beep. Just a quick question. I'm not sure if it's my turn, but it's a simple question. I was on 80 meters last week, and the other station was saying to me that, KC2QYW, you're getting a lot of RF. I'm hearing a lot of RF. My question is, what does he mean by that? And is it fixable? Can I buy something for my antenna so I don't get that RF on that 80 meters? Back to the net.
Okay. You didn't give it to me phonetically. He said he's giving you a lot of, it sounded like RF, Romeo Foxtrot, and then it sounded like Romeo Sierra. Give it to me phonetically. What did he say you were giving him a lot of? Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I'm sorry. RF. He's hearing RF coming out of my station on 80 meters.
KC2QIQ. Yeah, let me find out. Were you sending to him sideband or Morse code, Joe? Go ahead.
My fault. Sorry about that. I was using not the Morse code. I was using sideband. I was on sideband. And, yeah, so I wasn't using the, No Morse code. Speech.
Okay, I'm going to guess that it's carrier suppression he's talking about. Let's see what Glenn says. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, generally, Dick, when somebody's on 80 meters and they're telling you that you've got RF, usually what they mean is that you have RF superimposed on your audio. And what he was probably hearing was a large amount of distortion. And sometimes what will happen is, depending on how the antenna and the RF is, the grounds are connected inside, in other words, maybe sometimes between an amplifier and a transceiver, or your antenna connections and your tuner, sometimes you can actually get a little bit of bleed off of RF back into the microphone, and what happens is it creates a large distortion. So what he was probably trying to describe to him was he was hearing distortion on his audio signal that he believed was RF on his audio. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, that sounds like a definite possibility. Any kind of a leakage in the shielding of the mic cord can allow some of the transmitted RF to get back through the microphone into the earlier stages of the transmitter and give you a kind of a squeal feedback distortion. That's one possibility. And the other is, and this is a rare one with modern day rigs, carrier suppression. In other words, a good sideband transmitter should put out essentially 0 watts of signal when you're not talking. And if the balanced modulator was not properly set, there could be some RF in the background. Now, since the average guy will tune a sideband receiver such that he is nulling the carrier frequency, ordinarily you wouldn't know that. Although some people like to intentionally put the speech higher than normal, and in which case they would hear some carrier in the background. So Glenn thinks it's RF feedback into the microphone. I think it's a slim possibility it is carrier suppression. And if it's microphone, you want to check on the shielding of the cord. Make sure that's all working correctly. And try another microphone and see if you still get the same complaint. And if it's carrier suppression, let me drop it. Almost every rig has two controls in the modulator section, the balance modulator, which can adjust the phase and amplitude in order to reject the carrier that leaks through the balance modulator into the sideband filter. So we're not quite sure, but possibly one of those, Joe. Did he give you any other words of description of what he didn't like the sound of? KC2QIW, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger. I wish he did, but no, he just said it. He just said RF. I was using the Yaesu FT950 with a amplifier. So what I did was I lowered down my mic gain. I have a mic gain on that radio. I lowered it all the way down, and he said, "Oh, there you go. It's getting better." And then after that, I said 73 for now, you know, because I was getting, you know, getting a little frustrated with the RF problem. But on 20 meters, it works really, really good on 20 meters. So, yeah, thank you guys for the help, and I'll look into that, and I'll let you know what's going on. I'll let you know what's going on next week. Back to the day.
Yeah, it would have been nice if he called it RF feedback, as opposed to just saying RF. That's a little bit too brief. That's like a lot of people say, oh, I cook my food in the microwave. Well, it's really the microwave oven. They're leaving out the words. So if it was what Glenn was speculating, it would be RF feedback, and in which case turning down the mic gain could help that, depending on how many stages downrange the grief is coming in, so to speak. Yeah. So you don't get that complaint on 20 meters, if I understand correctly. Only on 80 meters you've gotten that. And you've only gotten that report from one guy. Is that true, Joe? Go ahead.
Yeah, there was a couple of stations out there. It was, you know, his buddy. Yeah, that one guy told me, and also his buddy told me about the RS problem. And I'll try to, when I have time, I'll try to fix I'm using a Alpha Delta wire antenna, a phantom dipole. So maybe I have to set it up a little higher or something. But I'll figure, when I get a chance, I got to read that antenna book, and I'll try to figure it out. So to answer your question, yeah, all the things, we're saying the same thing. Back to this.
Your antenna is mounted how far away from your transmitter, Joe? If it was 10 feet away, that could aggravate this problem. If it's 100 feet away, it's very much less likely. Over to you, Joe.
Yeah, roger that. Yep, you hit it on the button, Dick. It's only about 10 feet away from the ports. So, yep.
Yeah, with the antenna only 10 feet away, you're really pushing the state of the art, so to speak, of the amount of shielding you get from the microphone cord. And if the shielding wires on the outside of the microphone cord, some of them have broken away and not making good contact to the connector on the front panel, then that can aggravate the situation. RF gets picked up by the mic cord, it acts like an antenna, and you feed enough RF energy back into the audio circuit of your sideband transmitter. And during the times you're not talking, you'll hear some squeal, because ordinarily the output of the transmitter would go down to zero when you're not talking. But if you do have RF feedback, then when you stop talking, you'll hear this the squeal. That's the way it sometimes sounds. See, the nice thing, let me drop it.
Case 2 QIQ with an additional comment, sir.
Yeah, Glenn recognized. The nice thing about an FM transmitter is that you can always monitor yourself with FM. The fact that the receiver is being overloaded in amplitude, when the receiver is looking for frequency modulation, you get high fidelity out of your own local receiver when you're transmitting. It doesn't even have to be connected to much of an antenna. Sideband, you can't do that. Almost any local receiver in the shack with you will, even if it's on the same piece of property with you, the receiver, unless it's extremely well shielded, is going to be overloaded. Therefore, you can't make a judgment as to the quality of your sideband with your own local receiver. About the only way you can really judge the quality of a sideband is the right kind of a display oscilloscope, or have somebody a few miles away listen to your signal and feed it back to you over a telephone. See what Glenn's got to say. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, there's a couple ways to tackle this problem, Dick. One is that when you key down, look and see if you all of a sudden are generating a carrier. If you see a carrier on the output, you know you've got RF feedback in the microphone. So in other words, you should have very much suppressed carrier or low output power on key down when your quality of your audio is good on sideband. So you should only see the audio start to peak up, or the power start to peak up on speech. And sometimes what might happen is on key down, you don't see it, speak a little bit, and then leave a quiet pause and see if the power comes all the way back down again. If it doesn't, you've got RF feedback. Another way to monitor it is most sideband transceivers have a mic where you can plug in a set of headphones into your receiver, and usually there's a MONI or a monitor button which allows you to listen to your transmit audio from your transceiver. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Hey, that's very nice. A monitor audio button on the transmitter. A monitor audio connector, jack, plug, whatever. How many of the rigs do you know of have that audio monitor button on the transmitter section, Glenn? Go ahead.
Every sideband transceiver that I had has one. I guess it would have to be something pretty old not to have it. Usually, it's when you plug your headphones in, it's the same headphone jack as in other words, so in other words, you receive, where you're hearing your receive audio. When you go into transmit, usually there's a little button on the side that you can press in for monitor, or like a selector, you can put the switch into the selector position so that you can listen to your audio, so that you're not over-modulating or anything else on sideband. But it's also a very good indicator where if you've got RF, you'll hear a hum or some kind of additional noise on top of your audio.
I'm looking at the front panel of my old-fashioned Kenwood 520 right now.
and I don't think it's got a phone jack on the front panel for the receive mode, but it might not have that button on the front panel that allows me to do monitoring. Glenn, what do you think? It's too old?
Possibly. Sometimes just look in the manual. Usually right up in the front, if there's a monitor, it'll tell you that there's an audio monitor on the radio. I mean, heck, I even know CBs even have this thing on sideband. I mean, there's a lot of most radios on sideband usually have a monitor audio jack, so you can set the correct level. Usually, especially if you've got compression, like if you have compression on sideband, and you're trying to set your compression levels, usually the meter output is associated to a monitor, and usually there's one of the positions, like usually is AGC, fast, slow on the receive, and then there's usually a monitor position as well.
That's good to know. It's amazing that I've lived this many years in the ham radio world and didn't know that many rigs have that. In my case of my 2-meter all mode, Kenwood TS711, I'm not sure he's got it. He's got a phone plug in the front panel. Got lots of buttons, but I don't see one that fits that description. But I'm going to read both of those manuals when I get a chance. And with any further questions or comments on all of the above, unfortunately, we've only got 3 minutes left, 2 minutes left. Give me a call that is right now, K2RIW.
This is Victor Echo 3, X-Ray Sierra Hotel.
Go right ahead, Christian. VE3XSH, K2RIW.
A pretty valuable resource for me for checking my own HF output is a website called websdr.org. And that's a great site because it's got about 50 receiving stations around the world that you can link to, and you can tune them, and you get to listen to, of course, HF radio around the world. And if you want, you can find a radio station that you can... that can receive your signal, and you can sort of work on your signal, of course, because you can listen to it live, you know, but you're not listening to it locally, you're listening to it thousands of miles away, so it's handy. Probably better than trying to move that signal back to yourself by a telephone. Thanks so much. Back to that.
Christian, that sounds very good. Give me that web address a little bit more slowly. Something like WSDR.org, but I don't think I've got it all. Go ahead, Christian.
Yeah, it's websdr.org, so Whiskey, Echo, Baker, Sugar, Dixie, Roger, Dot, Oscar, Roger, Golf.
Okay, WEDSDR. So the web, I understand, SDR. I wonder what the SDR stands for. Any guesses, Christian?
Signal defined, oh no, software defined radio. They're usually sort of Pi, BlackBerry Pi, or just simple USB type receivers, so they can be controlled remotely.
Okay, so give me a couple of words now. If Joe goes to that website, websdr.org, the web is pretty much, the site is fairly self-explanatory. He will eventually be able to tell him who he is, where he is, and somebody will have a receiver set up somewhere that he can enable that software-defined radio to listen to his exact frequency. Then that frequency gets played back as audio on that website into his computer. Is that approximately what will take place, Christian?
That's correct. The only loud thing about the site is that he uses a Java plugin. You have to have Java running on your computer, but basically what happens is there's about 50 sites that you can go to from this one site, and it's a nice world map of all the SDR locations. So, for instance, the best location is in the University of Twente, Netherlands, and that's a 0 to 29.1 megahertz, so very broad. You go to that, click on that link, and then you see a picture of the actual hardware, and you have a large dial that you can use to tune throughout all the frequencies, and it plays a live audio feed of that receive.
Very fine. Christian, I thank you for that. Let me go over to the southern frequency. Oh, I can't do that. About that. All of a sudden, my receiver is not behaving the way it should. Thank you for that information. What you guys just listened to was segment number 1479 of the series that began in September of 1982. Bye-bye, you all. We'll be back next week. And see you down the log. John, KC2WGV, K2RIW listening. Bye-bye for now, here, John. See you guys later. Bye-bye, Joel. And if you do go to that website and you get feedback of your signal, please come back and tell us what you find. That's a brand new one on me. Bye-bye.
Yeah, if you've never checked out webfr.org, I think it's a miracle, and it's basically one of the things that got me totally addicted to radio and got me into the hobby in the first place, because I became aware of how much activity there was out there.
For visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Also connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Yeah.